This webcast is made possible in part by support from the listener members of the Classical Network, WWFM and WWFM.org. Thank you for your support.
It's an astonishing recording. The contrast, this piece starts with three slow quarter notes, C, B flat, A flat, and then a big crescendo to downbeat where the timpani joins. That crescendo is a thunderstorm, and then the hit of the timpani is it's galvanic. Poof! Joe, what are we listening to?
This is the final wartime broadcast of Wilhelm Furtwängler. The date is January 1945. Berlin is in rubbles. The Philharmonic's home has been destroyed. This is takes place in a building called the Admiral's Palast. This document seems to me essential for anybody who writes or thinks about the question, what was it like to live in Germany during the Second World War? books are written on this topic, but I wonder if any of the authors of those books, attempting to assess what it felt like, have ever heard this recording. And we'll listen to the entirety of the movement in a moment, because I think it tells us quite a lot. Angel, do you have any thoughts about what we just heard before we hear the whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly what Bill said. It's something that we don't hear anymore, unfortunately. This drama, this tragedy, this pathos. Of course, very special circumstances, but also a different approach to music. How many rehearsals for this, probably?
As many as he wanted.
And even more importantly, an orchestra that has worked with its music director for how many years, probably?
20 years by this time.
So where do we find this now?
You should introduce the show.
Hello, my friends. Welcome to Post-Classical. And this is anything but post-classical, although we have the major characters of post-classical here. Joseph Horowitz and Angel Gil Ordóñez are here with us. I'm your host. I guess I'm your host. I'm your delighted spectator, at least, along with all of you listening home. I'm Bill McLaughlin, and we are ready for an adventure. Joe, this is sort of like a Christmas present to yourself. You just bought this stack of recordings from Deutsche Grammophon. Tell me what this thing is. I see it's a huge bunch of records.
I plunked down $250, and so should you, on the website of the Berlin Philharmonic to purchase Wilhelm Furtwängler, the radio recordings, 1939 to 1945. It's 20-some-odd CDs. The book is fantastic. It's a hardcover book, about 200 pages. And from this book, what one learns about this performance is pretty important to understanding it and its significance. This is an eyewitness report by Carla Hoker, the German writer, who was there. And here's what she said. At noon, we take the S-Bahn to the Admiralspalast, an operetta theater of faded red velvet elegance. Now the Furtwängler concerts are given there because it is the only sizable hall that is still standing. Mm-hmm. On account of the current alarms in the evenings, it starts early, around 3 o'clock. Packed house. In the second movement of the Mozart symphony, there is a scary moment. The lights go out. Only a few emergency bulbs cast their bluish glow over Furtwängler, who continues to direct those musicians who are still playing. Then the sound drains away, leaving only the first violins, who know how it goes, on for a while. Furtwängler turns around, glances over the audience and the mute orchestra. Slowly he drops the baton. He leaves. The musicians follow. But the audience stays, except for a few who go out into the courtyard for a smoke. And the orchestra members, with their gray faces between the gray hangings above the stage, huddle around Furtwängler like frightened animals. From this, one can tell exactly what he is thinking, the same as everyone else. It's over.
Mm-hmm.
After about an hour, though, the lights come back on, the bell rings, the audience returns to their seats, the orchestra enters the stage, the oboe, they tune up. Many listeners must be thinking, as I am, of the broken Mozart melody, which still seems to float in the room. It is customary to repeat the last item after interruptions in a concert, but this time no one is surprised that Furtwängler gives the downbeat for the Brahms symphony. It is as if Mozartian beauty, blissfulness itself, no longer has a place in this city. And then the final performance of the wartime broadcasts, January 1945, was this very Brahms first. And all that survives from the tapes that were taken by the Russians and then returned only recently to the Germans is this last movement. And that is what we're about to listen to.
Well, I'm just trying to put this in some kind of context.
Yeah, you better put it into some kind of context.
To the West, it's the Battle of the Bulge. I mean, this is 6 months, 8 months after D-Day, January. And to the East, the Red Army, you know, continues with its inexorable drive toward Berlin. And meanwhile, the Allies have been bombing the bejesus out of Berlin for years now, and it's in ruins. The old Philharmonic Hall is gone.
Yep.
That's why they're playing at this funny place with the faded red velvet seats. What must it have felt like?
That's the context, thank you very much, in which we must hear and ponder the next 10 minutes of music.
I'm willing to try. I mean, that just what we heard of the, we played the introduction, the C minor up to the spot where the horn comes in, the C major, and we get a clue of what we're going to get. But this sort of also sums up what's been in the whole three movements before that, and maybe the whole years from 1939, you said? Oof.
Yeah, there's a statement here which we will ponder once we've recovered from the shock of hearing this entire finale. So Here we go.
Buckle your seatbelts. The tempi are completely visionary in a way. I mean, it's slow. It's really slow. If it's a stringendo, it's with the string pizzicato, it's almost out of control. It sounds like it could be a farce if it were Rossini, but it's not. It's dead serious. This is surprising music making. Berlin Philharmonic, January 1945, and Furtwängler at the podium. listening to that sound dying away in that hall. I'm going to keep it going forever. What a recording. What an experience. January 1945 in Berlin. The end is here, and they're still playing like that.
When I was listening, I was thinking of the conversation we had with Solomon Volkov, thinking about Shostakovich preparing in his bag every night his manuscript and the toothpaste, thinking that that might be his last night at home.
Wow.
Is what I felt listening to this. Furtwängler saying, this might be the last time I'm conducting the symphony. The silence at the end, you didn't hear any applause there.
No.
This is what I felt. Musicians, the timpani player.
Genius.
Who probably is the one that has in this beautiful, there's a beautiful video clip that they always show my conducting students where he talks about Furtwängler, about his charisma, etc. I'm sure he's the
same. Tell the story. Go ahead.
It's an incredible story about the charisma of the maestro. He was the timpani player of the orchestra, and he likes to have, during rehearsals, the full score. Because, you know, they have, like, so many measures without playing. There was a guest conductor, and the orchestra was sounding beautiful, so he was looking at the score because he had to play. And then suddenly, the sound of the orchestra is completely different. It transforms itself. And then he just looks what is going on. Furtwängler is coming from the aisle.
Down into the hall.
Entering the hall. And just his presence changes completely the sound of the orchestra. Isn't that fascinating? I always show this to my conducting students. So to me, this might be the last time we play this together. So no concessions. It's incredible. I never heard this recording before, and I don't think I have heard a version of this movement as dramatic and as, I mean, it has everything.
He plays upon it for drama in a way that most of us nowadays wouldn't dare. I mean, because we consider Brahms, we would give him a little more of a classical touch. This is wildly romantic at that, wildly intuitive. And it's funny because the beginning is so slow. It puts you in a dream state. But then the livelier music, it's not just lively. It's not brisk. There's an almost terrifying urgency.
It's desperation. Desperation. The C major, we're not happy because we have a C major. We have to go over it. Go over the C major. Go over the C major. Why should we be happy in 1945 where we are right now with our city completely destroyed?
What I experience is so overwhelming, I can barely talk about it. I experience this performance as an expression of pride and defiance, declaring this is the real Germany.
Yeah,
for not sure. Goebbels, not Hitler.
I know.
And it vindicates everything Furtwängler ever said about why he stayed.
Well, you know, he started out in 33, talking about Hitler. He said, this little hissing street peddler, he will never make it in Germany. The German people will not accept him. They kept fighting against it so long. Hissing street peddler.
But, you know, Furtwängler has been so presumptuously criticized for not leaving Germany. And he always said the same thing. And it's right here in this performance why he needed to stay. To keep the flame burning.
Schoenberg said the same thing. Schoenberg, writing from the U.S., Schoenberg was a Viennese Jew, lived in Berlin, taught in Berlin, came to the U.S., and he heard the stuff in America about, oh, Furtwängler, what is he doing staying there? He said, no, Furtwängler is precisely the sort of German who must stay in Germany.
So he's been vilified to such a degree and so presumptuously for this decision. And he did occasionally think of leaving, and he had to flee at the very end. But as I said 20 minutes ago, if you want to write a book, as many have, about what it was like to live in Germany under Hitler, you have to listen to this. Because what it tells you is that there is a portion of that population that's keeping alive a vision of Kunst, of German culture, even in the face of this insanity and barbarism. And as you just said, he was needed, and he knew it.
Folks, if any of you have just tuned in, you are actually listening to post-classical, although this is a very sort of pre-post-classical what we're doing today. Joe Horwitz brought in his new collection, which is actually very old recordings. Tell us about the collection and why we're listening to it today, Joe.
I will do so, but I'm also going to give you the Schoenberg quote that you just referred to. We're listening to this because we need to. These are the surviving wartime broadcast recordings of Wilhelm Furtwängler, probably the conductor today who excites the greatest interest of all conductors living and dead. Not a man for all seasons, not a conductor for all seasons. You wouldn't want to necessarily hear him do, say, Beethoven 4, which is also in this box. But he embodies something so profound, like it or leave it, that is German. It's incapacitating and debilitating and dangerous, but it's also exalted and inspiring and necessary. And especially in wartime, and probably the later you got into the war, the more it was the case, his performances embody almost an apotheosis of what he stood for. And as I said, not everybody cares for it. I do. But I also recognize that it unleashes, we all know this about German culture, it's written about all the time.
Sure thing.
It unleashes elemental factors in the human condition that can easily go awry. Yep. And Hitler adored Bruckner, and he adored Wagner. Here's what Schoenberg said. This isn't exactly what you were referring to, but it's still
close
worth reading. This is Schoenberg now in Los Angeles. Schoenberg had to leave, because he would be dead if he didn't leave. I'm sure he was never a Nazi. He is one of those old-fashioned Deutsch-Nationale from the time of Turnvater Jan, when you were national because of those Western states who went with Napoleon. This is more an affair of Studentennationalismus, and it differs very much from that of Bismarck's time and later on, when Germany was not a defender but a conqueror. Also, I am sure that he was no anti-Semite, or at least no more than any non-Jew. And he is certainly a better musician than all these Toscaninis, Ormandys, Koussevitzkys, and the whole rest. So, yeah, Schoenberg's somebody who would have understood Furtwängler. They come out of the exact same German notion of culture. Another thing I wanted to say, and we could talk for 2 hours and never listen to another recording, is he's a disciple of Wagner as a conductor.
Sure.
And what Wagner says, there's a lot of things that we just heard. You can never be too fast.
Or
you can never
slow.
Be too slow.
Right.
But what he crucially says is, in terms of Werktreue, fidelity, what is it that makes an interpretation faithful to the text? You have to seize the idea. He says it's the hardest thing. It's not in the notes. You have to know the idea of the piece. So Angel, when we did Opus 131 by Beethoven, you conducted it. My program note was Wagner's famous note on Opus 131. He had an idea that it was a day in the life of Beethoven.
Right. If you guys are scuffling, that's one of the late quartets, one of the most profound and one of the biggest of the late string quartets of Beethoven.
So it doesn't even matter, ultimately, if it's the right idea or the wrong idea, but Wagner said you have to have the right idea. Furtwängler said exactly the same thing. He called it das Ganze.
The whole thing.
Yeah, so if you're doing Brahms 1, far more important than tempo relationships or orchestral balance is, do you know the idea? And he also said, Arau said this too when I interviewed him for my book, Conversations with Arau, there's only one correct idea. I can't buy that myself, but for him, it mattered. Mm-hmm. For Arau, it mattered. If you don't do the Brahms D minor concerto first movement slow, you have the wrong idea. Well, and if he didn't believe that, he wouldn't have been such a great exponent of the Brahms D minor concerto. And Furtwängler came to this music and he said, this is the right idea. And the chips, they fall where they may. And I have even one more thing to say, which is that when he channels music, because that's what he does, he doesn't really conduct. And the orchestra channels it with him, which is why, notwithstanding Riccardo Muti, orchestras are not better today than they ever were. They're not as good as they used to be. But he's also doing something Shostakovich does. He channels the occasion. He lives the moment.
Exactly.
And I was thinking, my new thought about this performance, which I now write about, is that it's so evocative of this famous story of the Leningrad Symphony being performed in Leningrad during the siege, and everybody feeling that it had somehow embodied the moment, and everybody fed off of it.
Yep.
Shostakovich had this capacity, which other composers didn't have, like Prokofiev didn't have, to channel the moment for a great audience.
Exactly.
This and Furtwängler, he does it.
That's the crucial, in my opinion, that's the crucial thing. And Bill, as you know, I worked with Celi Vidache for almost 7 years.
I was going to bring him up. You folks don't know this name. Sergiu Celibidache.
Sergiu Celibidache.
Romanian conductor who came to Berlin right after the
right
war.
After Furtwängler. So he actually was the one that rebuilt the Berlin Philharmonic, and he shared the music directorship of the Berlin Philharmonic with Furtwängler when Furtwängler came back from Switzerland after being denazified. What a terrible war. So always, I remember, and it's actually, Celibidache's approach to music comes from Furtwängler. And he approached him once and said, Dr. Furtwängler, how do you think this goes? This moment, and I think it was Schubert or something. And Furtwängler says, it depends on how it sounds.
Oh, God, yeah.
So that's the whole philosophy of Furtwängler. Is that what you say?
Yeah.
And this is Celibidache later. How it sounds. You don't take a look at the metronomic markings. What is a mezzo forte? How does it sound? So it depends on how it sounds. In 1945, if we listen now to another recording of this last movement of Furtwängler conducting this, it would be completely different, I'm sure. But he lives the moment. It's the spontaneity. This is, to me, the best, most important learning from Celibidache, which somehow I feel grandson of the Furtwängler tradition, is precisely that. Live the moment, being spontaneous on what is going on in that moment with this orchestra, in this hall, in this circumstance.
So would you introduce us to the next track? We're going to hear the first movement of Bruckner 9. This is the only recording we have of Furtwängler doing Bruckner 9. It is from the wartime broadcasts, and it is from October 1944. It's quite a famous performance. What would you like to tell us about the first movement of Bruckner 9?
Joe and I had a conversation before the show about the different approach of Bruckner by Furtwängler and Celibidache. I mean, Joe already mentioned what is the idea, looking for the idea in Furtwängler's mind. For Celibidache, Bruckner is probably the best tool for Westerns to meditate. So it's transcending thought. It's exactly the opposite way. It's a tool for just transcend life, transcend the moment. So I'm curious because I never heard this. So I rather speak about it later, but I think that's interesting, you know, the two different ways to approach Bruckner.
I should point out this is the last of Bruckner's symphonies, and he wrote, what, three movements, left it not quite finished. Some people have taken a crack at it, but it is a profound statement right at the end of the life of Anton Bruckner.
Yeah, it really does feel like a valedictory. He was ill. He probably knew very well that this would be his last symphony. It, of course, is also the Ninth Symphony, which is an iconic number. And this is a very long and important first movement. Again, we're talking about October 1944.
So here we go. Opening movement of the Bruckner Ninth Symphony. Berlin Philharmonic with Wilhelm Furtwängler on the podium. Wow, what a piece. Tremendous canvas.
That's an extraordinary ending, actually.
Yeah. Bruckner's such an interesting character. On the face of it, he looks like rather an uncomplicated character. He's a kind of country boy from Upper Austria. Grew up around a monastery, wonderful St. Florian's Abbey outside Linz. Became the organist there, this magnificent organ. So I think that put those two together, country kid playing one of the world's great organs. When I listen to Bruckner's music, more than when I played it or conducted it, just listen to it. There's always something about Bruckner that puts me in mind of a train of pilgrims.
Mm-hmm.
They're always moving. They move rather slowly, but they never stop moving. And that's what I think Furtwängler is getting here.
We should mention that that was the first movement of Bruckner's Ninth Symphony, performed in October 1944 by the Berlin Philharmonic on a radio broadcast conducted by Wilhelm Furtwängler.
So, Einhell, you worked with the great Sergiu Celibidache. Tell me all about him. I never met him. I sort of admired him from a very great distance, but you spent 7 years studying with him.
In touch with him until his death, but working with him, I would say 6 years and then 1 year, you know, coming back and forth. This is really so interesting to compare these two different approaches to Bruckner. Although, I mean, there is, of course, a lot in common. This is the first time I actually heard this
recording.
I feel this is a much more Wagnerian approach to Bruckner. Celibidache enjoys the moment more, in my opinion. He builds, probably he exaggerates a little bit in how he builds the tension, but it truly becomes a very profound spiritual experience. So you can imagine, he started every season with the Munich Philharmonic. We went all to St. Florian. He would play a Bruckner symphony in St. Florian.
Wow.
That was how the season of the Munich Philharmonic
started. Which is the church in which Bruckner was
exactly,
was an organist.
The church in which Bruckner, as you said, Bill, was the organist. It was beyond, it was really a true, true spiritual experience. So I think that's the difference.
It's kind of a long way from Munich.
It is. It's actually
to Linz.
Yeah, to Linz, to St. Florian. So there is a difference. I think, again, to Joe's comment on the idea, the Wagnerian idea, and a more mystic approach to the music. For Celibidache, Bruckner was the quintessential and the limits of the sonata form. What Bruckner did was to extend the possibilities of the sonata form to the limits. That's why also the symphonies are so long, because, you know, we have 3-4 themes. And the way he was able to build the tension and how to distend that, in my opinion, I've never heard anything like that.
You know, there's an interesting tension with Bruckner, in the same way that there's a tension with Johannes Brahms' music between the classical and the romantic impulses. Here's a man, Bruckner, writing in a very classical form, a little bit past its heyday, and he's also in love with Richard Wagner. I mean, really in love with the music of Wagner. He dedicated a symphony to him. When Wagner died, he put a little bit for the tenor tubas to sing him a song to wish him well. You know, this kind of, he was dedicated to Wagner. They don't go together, you wouldn't think. But I think that's the tension that makes it so interesting.
No doubt. And then something that is incredible in Furtwängler, both, and of course, Celibidache took that from him, is how the pauses, the rest are structured. So you see, we breathe with the orchestra. There's nothing happening between some sections. And we need that silence. You don't hear that anymore. Mm-hmm. This waiting for the next
moment.
It's incredible. I mean, and both in Brahms and here in Bruckner was fabulous what Furtwängler did in that sense.
Joe, you put the set of records in. How many records in this set?
I think 22.
And I think we first talked about this about a month ago. You were really excited. Have you gotten through all 22? You couldn't have.
It's not something that you can casually listen to.
Uh-huh.
I'm kind of afraid of it.
So, well, I think you showed some respect, is what I was saying.
Yeah, you have to be in the mood to enter into these performances. I sampled enough to know that not every piece of music benefits from being played during World War II with Wilhelm Furtwängler conducting. I tried a little bit of the Mozart. Didn't really interest me. The Fourth Symphony I was interested in is Beethoven 4, because I love that symphony. But his notion of the symphony, which has no humor in it, doesn't really, it's interesting, but it's not really kindred to my experience of the piece.
He certainly had no humor. Have you seen him rehearsing with them? There are some excerpts of him rehearsing with the Berlin Philharmonic. Is the least humorous person you can imagine.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Till Eulenspiegel I listened to. It's interesting. It's dramatic. It doesn't really have a sharp sense of humor. I think his Meistersinger overture is also compromised because what's pompous in that piece is pompous on purpose. I once had an argument with somebody who had played it and complained that the piece was pompous, and I said, it's supposed to be pompous. That's the idea. He's poking fun. At least in parts, he's poking fun at the Meistersinger.
But you have to play it as if you believe in that pomposity. You have to take that to heart.
There's a wonderful interpretation by Knoppertsbusch. He really gets that overture, I feel, more than Furtwängler does. But the set as a whole is such a humbling experience. You don't want to ever listen to any of these recordings casually.
So this is not actually probably a set of recordings you're going to take to the beach, I'm guessing, Joe. But what interesting radio listening it makes. We're listening to this set, or excerpts of this set, very large set from Berlin Philharmonic, conducted by Furtwängler during the years 1939 to 1945. This is precisely the time of the Second World War. And these recordings were carried off by the Soviets and held in Russia for a very long time, and only recently redeemed, returned to the West, and the Berlin Philharmonic took them over, shined them up, and put them in this beautiful box. It's fun to look at the box. You said the book with it is over 200 pages long. It's very scholarly.
It's excellent, too. Very, very informative.
So, folks, that's what we're doing here today on Post Classic with Joe Horowitz, Angel Gil Ordóñez. I'm your host, Bill McLaughlin. And we'll be back in just a moment, because we got a lot more music coming up.